The Nation State of Play podcast is produced by IBC Media in San Diego, California. Hi, and welcome to Nation State of Play. I'm your host, Brian Miller. On each episode of this podcast, we explore high-impact topics determining the future of our nation state. Thanks for listening today. Our guest is Lindsay Bolo with the Partnership to End Addiction. She is one of the leading advocates in the country on various things that Washington really needs to be doing to have an impact on the opioid crisis, but on the addiction crisis generally in the United States. I feel like this is an issue that doesn't get nearly enough attention, and it truly is a public health crisis in addition to the most notable public health crisis that we are facing. So we have a great talk about what Washington can do here, specifically about some of the members of the California delegation who can have a big impact on this. Really appreciate you listening. And then in the show notes, you're going to find ways that if you're interested in learning more about her organization or ways to get involved in this, they will all be posted there. So Lindsay Bolo coming right up after these messages with the Partnership to End Addiction.
American democracy's good, but we can make it better. The National Association of Nonpartisan Reformers includes organizations across the country who are working right now to build a better democracy by opening primaries, implementing safe, secure voting systems, reducing corruption, and increasing transparency. Listen to our weekly podcast, How to Win Friends and Save the Republic, to hear updates from the latest movements in the democracy reform space. Subscribe and learn more about us at nonpartisanreformers.org.
Welcome back to the Nation State of Play podcast. Well, Lindsay, thanks so much for being on the show today. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you start by giving us a little bit of an overview of your organization and what you focus on?
Sure. So Partnership to End Addiction was formed in 2019. By a merger of two of really the most longstanding organizations, addiction organizations in the field. So Center on Addiction and Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. Center on Addiction was founded as the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, or CASA, in 1992 by Joseph Califano, who was the former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare for President Carter. And CASA was really established to assemble all of the skills and disciplines needed to assess and address the impact of alcohol, tobacco, drug use and addiction on all sectors of society. And the organization really became a leader in conducting and synthesizing research and working to really bridge the gap between what the research showed to be effective in preventing substance use with what was actually happening in policy to practice. Partnership for Drug-Free Kids was founded in 1986 as Partnership for Drug-Free America. And it was founded by marketing and media executives who believed that the persuasive power of marketing would be effective in preventing young people from trying substances. And so Partnership created many iconic public service announcements about substance use risk. In the early 2000s, they evolved from an organization focused primarily on public service campaigns to providing science-based resources and services to help parents seeking help for their loved ones' substance use and addiction. And so as the merged organization and combining these two legacies, our mission now is really to transform how our nation addresses addiction, and doing so by empowering families, by advancing effective care, by shaping public policy, and by changing culture.
Great. Well, that's a super helpful background. So I'd like to zero in a little bit more on what you do in the advocacy space. We're a Sacramento-focused show. We got a lot of policy wonks, policy insiders, and some of the topics you're working on, I think, are presenting themselves in a lot of different ways in California right now. So maybe just start with a little bit of an overview of what you do in the advocacy space, and then I want to tackle some of these specific topics within it.
Sure. Yeah. So all of our work is really focused on centered around families. And so we provide direct family services, and all those services are free. And, you know, if your listeners are interested in those, there's information about all of them available on our website, which is drugfree.org. And then our policy and advocacy work is really centered around identifying barriers that families face, and developing and recommending solutions to those barriers, and educating policymakers about those barriers and how to overcome, solutions to overcome them. And then we work on advocacy to engage advocates in policy change. And so our advocacy work is really focused on galvanizing families who've been impacted by addiction and really encouraging them to speak up and to share their stories and experiences. Addiction has long been shrouded in secrecy. People and families are often blamed and shamed for addiction, and so they do not come forward and they don't speak up. That's starting to change, and many families who have been impacted and families who have been impacted in incredibly devastating ways really want to give back and recognize a lot of the systemic barriers and challenges that they face, and they don't want other families to go through that. And so they really have become really powerful advocates in this area by sharing their stories, which help to really humanize and personalize a lot of the barriers that are out there. And so, you know, we think of advocacy really broadly as speaking up, and we create a lot of tools and resources to help people advocate and to understand that advocacy doesn't mean traveling to DC and, you know, having a face-to-face meeting with your congressperson, but is really just using your voice and sharing your experience. And so we actually, and we really believe that the recipe for policy change is combining, right, our policy research around barriers and solutions with people's personal stories. And that's really what will move the needle on policy change.
Right. So are you active at the federal and state levels?
Just the federal level.
Okay. So I'd like to talk about some of these federal priorities on a few different topics. Obviously, getting anything done these days in Washington, we know, is a challenge. So I'd love to hear about your experiences on sort of like where you are in the process and if there's anything, you know, sort of potentially to pass in the short run. I know some of this is regulatory, some of this is legislative, but let's start with opioids. Obviously, this is a huge topic. People across the country are concerned about it. What should the federal government be doing in this space?
Yeah. So just broadly, the federal government, you know, the role for the federal government is really to provide more funding. They have been providing funding. They've been providing historic levels of funding, but that funding is very small, and it is a drop in the bucket compared to the magnitude of the crisis and the costs associated with addiction, with untreated and unaddressed addiction. And the other issue with the funding has been the federal government has been making very short-term investment funding awards. So, you know, it's not enough. Or it's not sufficient for the type of real, like, long-term infrastructure changes that are really needed to be made right now, because we really need to have major systems changes in how we're addressing addiction. And there are some specific federal laws that are creating barriers, especially around the delivery of medications for opioid use disorder. So there are federal laws around prescribing of buprenorphine, which require prescribers to undergo additional training or obtain a waiver or certification from the federal government to prescribe buprenorphine, and then they can only prescribe to a limited number of patients. That has really been identified as a barrier to buprenorphine access. And then methadone is one of the other FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder, which is subject to a very strict federal legal and regulatory scheme about how it can be delivered and administered. And then, you know, there's a lot that the states can do as well to expand, you know, treatment and access to treatment and prevention and everything. So there's a lot of work going on at both the federal and at the state level.
So getting back to the federal funding, there's some huge spending bills working their way through, as you well know right now. Any chance to get increased, more long-term funding in any of the legislation that's hopefully getting close to the finish line here?
You know, there seems to be some like plus ups of funding here and there. There was some more funding that went out in some of the COVID relief bills, you know, to give more funding through like the block grant programs and whatnot. But we really aren't seeing, you know, any type of like significant investment in addiction. It's there's certainly been more attention and there has been more money, but it's been like a lot of tinkering, like around the edges of sort of our current policies and not the type of like really transformational change that we're seeing with COVID, for example, right? We've got two really significant public health crises in this country, COVID and an addiction, and we seem to be taking very different approaches, you know, in our response to those crises.
So what's the obstacle to getting that done? This is one of the things we're always really interested in the show, is like who's preventing that? When you go in and you meet with leadership and you talk about these issues, do they nod their heads and say, "We agree, we're working on it," or do they just say, "We don't have the money," or like how do those conversations go?
Yeah, I think that it's really it's less who's the obstacle and what's the obstacle. And the biggest obstacle is stigma. The stigma against addiction is so pervasive. And it's getting better. We are seeing stigma reduce a bit in that 10 to 15 years ago, we wouldn't even be talking about addiction. Lawmakers certainly wouldn't be talking about it. And now they do. They want to talk to advocates, and they want to understand the impact of policy changes, on people with substance use disorder. And so that's a really significant change. But I don't think we're seeing, I think we're still seeing stigma in kind of the lack of political will, to make these really big changes. It's also going to take some time, right? We've been using We need to completely change the way we've been addressing addiction, which is largely that we were addressing it as a criminal issue, a criminal justice issue, and taking a very punitive response. And we need to shift to a much more health-based response. So we need to move the healthcare system in that direction, which is a really big move. I think there's definitely interest among lawmakers. I think they care about this. I think this is an issue that touches so many people, and so many, many people have a personal connection to this. I think our tone around addiction has changed a lot, where it is recognized as more of a health issue. People are coming at it from, a more compassionate standpoint. But there seems to be sort of this holdup in sort of like, we understand that this is a disease. We understand we need to treat it compassionately, but we're not seeing that translate into the type of urgent action that's really required.
So let's talk about current legislative efforts then, or regulatory efforts at the federal level. What are your asks that you have pending right now that Congress could move on now that would have an impact in this space?
Yeah, so there's a number of bills that are currently introduced that align with a lot of our policy priorities. And so, one of our major priorities is really expanding access to quality treatment. And so, I think that the way that that is really going to be achieved is through integrating the addiction treatment with the mainstream healthcare system. Because right now, the addiction treatment system continues to operate outside of the mainstream healthcare system. And this goes back to, viewing addiction as more of a criminal justice issue. It was not something that was considered to be within the purview of the healthcare system. One of the ways to really integrate addiction treatment is to train healthcare providers. Right now, healthcare providers receive very little training on substance use, even though it is a prevalent chronic illness. So there is a bill that would require anyone who has a license to prescribe controlled substances under the DEA to undergo substance use disorder training. So that would be a good step. It wouldn't really be, it wouldn't sort of get at everyone. We'd want to really see like all healthcare providers and really all professionals who are interacting with people who may be at risk or may have substance use disorder, to really be trained in identifying, treating, managing, knowing how to refer, to services. So that type of, bill would, the training requirement would sort of help push the healthcare system to take on, more of that.
In case listeners want to read more about that bill, do you have the bill number
It's
handy?
the MATE Act.
Great. So yeah, I'd love to dig into that bill a little bit more. Just if people want to read more about it or pull it up, do you have a bill number handy?
Sure. So it's in the House, it's HR 2067, and in the Senate Bill 2235.
Great.
It's the Medication Access and Training Expansion Act, or the MATE Act.
Right. So, who are the lead sponsors on this bill? At least in the Senate, I probably don't want to list off all the House members, but who's your champions here?
So Bennett and Senator Bennett and Collins seem to be are the I think Bennett's the lead sponsor, and Susan Collins is the co-sponsor in the Senate.
Great. And I know Senator Bennett's been super thoughtful on these topics. I've personally heard him talk about it a lot, both as senator and when he was running for president too. So, So we've got a few fairly important people who get a say in that process, the speaker and the minority leader. And, you know, I think what's interesting about their districts on this particular topic, they actually have pretty acute problems that have manifested themselves in different ways. Even though their districts are culturally very diverse, opioids are a huge problem, actually, both in San Francisco and in Bakersfield. And I think that's actually a good illustration of the problem. I mean, do you think members of Congress sort of understand that this is a problem that affects wide swaths of geography and what different, sort of different political spectrums across the map?
I think so. This is like addiction knows no bounds. You know, it affects everyone, regardless of race, socioeconomic status, you know, geographic location. And I think a real inflection point for that was the 2016 election, where all of the candidates, spoke out about addiction from a personal, as a personal issue. And I think that was something that really changed the narrative in the way that lawmakers have been talking about this, where they have been more willing to speak about their personal issue, you know, their personal connection, family members who have been impacted. And I think as well, people, constituents have really been speaking up and bringing this to their attention and really putting pressure on lawmakers to do something in a way that really hadn't happened before.
So what is the agency role here versus what Congress needs to do? I understand like funding it, of course, at some level needs to come from Congress, but then you get into a lot of discretion about how the agencies can actually allocate, billions of dollars. What concerns you, or what do you think is the opportunities at the agency level?
So, one of our other priorities, is not only expanding access to treatment and not only making sure that there's more treatment available, because that, we know that the majority of people with substance use disorder aren't able to get treatment, but also making sure that it's affordable. And a lot of my work is really focused on insurance coverage. And this is one area where the agencies play a huge role, because we actually have a really good law on the books. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act has been the law for well over a decade, but it is not strongly enforced. It's a law where enforcement authority lies with the federal government, primarily Department of Labor, CMS, as well for Medicaid, and then with states for state regulated insurance. So because insurance is very complicated, there's some is under federal law and some is under state law. But that's an area where agencies could really improve insurance coverage by much more strongly, by strongly enforcing a law that's already on the books. And so, in a lot of cases, yes, we do need an act of Congress to make changes. We do need an act of Congress, we do need Congress to provide more funding. But then we also need to make sure that we're enforcing things, we're enforcing laws, so that people get the protections that they're, that they provide. And also when we do put this funding out, that it's going towards programs that are evidence-based. That's been another big issue with addiction, is especially on the treatment side, it's not subject to the same regulatory oversight as the healthcare system, because again, it kind of operates in this like shadow system. And so there's a lot of issues with adherence to evidence-based standards, with quality standards. And that's really something that needs to improve, because we don't want to keep putting more money into poor treatment. That's going to lead to really bad outcomes for patients. And that's something we've really been focused on lately when talking about the money that could be going to the states from the opioid settlement funds, right? If there's going to be an influx of funding, let's make sure that money gets spent wisely and on good quality programs that are going to improve the situation and not, kind of get thrown into poor treatment or programs that just aren't supported by evidence.
It's a great flag. So we've got a few members of the Labor Committee in the California Congressional Delegation. So hope y'all are hearing that. It's a good topic for an oversight hearing, probably. And I'm glad you flagged it. So one of your other topics that you guys focus on is flavored tobacco. I know this is a huge issue across the country. In California, we have recently banned flavored tobacco. The that's up for a referendum because the tobacco companies, in their never-ending zeal for extending their markets, are continuing to fight it. But what I've heard, and we've done a few episodes about this with advocates focused on the state level, is a lot of frustration at the federal level about how the feds have just been dragging their heels on this for quite a long time now, and certainly a lot of hope that as states move to ban it, that might push them along. What do you see going on at the federal level here? What do you see as the role for the federal government?
Yeah, you know, much of the same as the other advocates have shared. You know, when it comes to legal addictive substances, you know, vaping, increasingly marijuana at the state level, alcohol, tobacco, like our major concern is on protecting youth and making sure that these substances are regulated, you know, so that flavors are banned. We're also, you know, reducing exposure and access, restricting marketing and advertising, requirements around, you know, disclosing ingredients and contents, packaging requirements, just all things to make sure that you know, access to the youth have restricted access to these substances, because we know that early initiation of use significantly increases the risk for developing addiction later in life. And that these, you know, addictive substances really have an impact on the developing brain. And so, yeah, we would love to see greater oversight on these things from the federal government. Unfortunately, industry kind of uses the same playbook, right, where they introduce these substances into society, and regulations always come too late. And after, you know, there's already been an impact on youth. We just saw it happen with vaping. We've seen it happen in the past with tobacco and alcohol. And, you know, looking to the future, as more and more states are legalizing marijuana, you know, that's sort of going to be the next issue. And so we have actually been, one thing we're working on now, more at the state level, less advocacy, but more policy recommendations, is really trying to identify strong youth protection provisions for states that are legalizing marijuana, to make sure that they're really prioritizing youth protection in those regulations.
Right. So I think to the tobacco one brings up an important point, which is it's fairly obvious who advocacy groups like yourself are fighting in the tobacco space. Big tobacco spends more on politics than any industry in the country, and it's not even close. Are you fighting opioid manufacturers on these issues? Are they opposing the reforms and the funding and the things you're seeking? It doesn't sound like it's maybe as blatant, because it's maybe even more unseemly than what tobacco does, but are they opposition?
At this moment, you know, they still do fight, you know, any taxes on their products that would sort of go towards addressing the crisis. You know, they've really fought having to pay for disposal mechanisms. So, you know, there, I think any way in which there's an attempt to regulate the industry, any of these industries, in a way that will impact, you know, their profits, they tend to come out against that. You know, I think a lot of the opioid manufacturers are publicly, you know, acknowledging the scope of the crisis and what's happened, but the litigation is still dragging on and on and on. And so, you know, there are certainly industries at play here as well, you know, powerful industries. And another big, you asked me before, who's opposing this? Obviously, all of those industries, and the insurance industry as well, you know, really opposing efforts to enforce laws that are requiring them to cover, you know, and pay for treatment for people with substance use disorder, and, you know, any type of enforcement of those requirements.
Really?
So there's definitely, a lot of powerful, you know, opposition.
All right. Well, we're really glad to have you on the show. You're doing so many important things. I want people to know where to find you and how they can participate and get involved in your work. So what's the best place to go online?
Yeah. So our website is drugfree.org. And we have there, we have a lot of information about our services. So we provide We provide free services to families who are impacted by addiction. So we have a helpline that can provide one-on-one support. We have parent coaching, which offers peer support from trained volunteer parents who have lived experience. We have tons of online resources for parents, also on marijuana, alcohol, prescription drugs, and vaping. We have resources specific for educators, healthcare providers, and parents. We also have text-based support and an online support community. So a variety of different resources to really help reach parents. And then on our advocacy work, we have some action alerts up on various pieces of federal legislation. So if folks are interested in contacting their members of Congress, they can just complete an action alert and it will send a letter to their member of Congress. So we have them on a variety of bills. If you go to drugfree.org, you can then press on Get Involved tab and then Advocate for Change. And you'll see all of our different action alerts. We also have a new advocacy tool that we released this year. It's a webpage we're calling Help Us Change the Story of Addiction. And what we've done is used personal stories to really illustrate the policy barriers and the systemic challenges that people are facing to offer a policy solution and then to offer an opportunity to advocate, usually by signing one of those action alerts or encouraging other people to share their stories so we can continue to grow this database. But again, those personal stories are really powerful with policymakers in helping them to really understand the impact of policies on people and also to change policies as well.
Great. Well, we appreciate that. We'll put links to those sites in the show notes because we got a few different ones there. I want to make sure people can find it. So, Lindsay, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for fighting a good fight. Great to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. I really appreciate it.
We invite you to share story ideas, comments, and questions. Find us at NeptuneOps.com or on Twitter at NationStateOfP1. Again, that's at NationStateOfP and then the number one. Follow us and subscribe to listen to all of our episodes as we continue to explore the inside stories driving California policy. This is the Nation State of Play podcast, exploring the inside political stories driving public policy in California, powered by Neptune Ops and presented by IVC Media. I'm your host, Brian Miller, and thank you for listening.